are already here. The climate solutions are in the ancestral science of indigenous communities and knowledges, so we're demanding that to be respected.
I want to thank you both so much for being with us, Andrea Ikshu, Maya Quiche, journalist and activist from Guatemala, Rosa Marina Flores Cruz, indigenous activist from Oaxaca, Mexico, both with the collective Futuros Indígenas, that's Indigenous Futures, here at the UN Climate Summit in Sharm el-Sheikh. And now for an update about the case of Ala Abdel Fattah. His family visited with him today in the Wadi El Natroun prison. His sister Mona Saif, who was not there today, tweeted, "The news from the visit is not good. Ala suffered a lot in this last period, but at least they saw him and he needed to see them very much." The family says they'll share more details later this afternoon. We'll tweet them out, and we'll have more on Ala's case on Friday's program. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez will be giving a speech Friday at the Columbia School of Journalism, reflecting on his 40 years of fighting for racial and social justice in journalism. It begins at 4:10 p.m. Friday. See democracynow.org for details on this event and two other speeches Juan is giving. Special thanks to Sharifa Abdelkadous, Hani Massoud, Dennis Moynihan, Nermeen Sheikh here in Sharm el-Sheikh. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Nancy Pelosi is stepping down as House Speaker, but she will continue to represent California and the U.S. House.
Standing here today, I'm endlessly grateful for all of life's blessings.
Oregon's about to enact some of the most strict gun control in the country, but with a lot of challenges ahead. And the fight to end childhood hunger in Oregon gets a new champion. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 17th, 2022. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced today that she will not run for a leadership post after leading House Democrats for two decades. Arguably the most powerful woman ever in American politics, the Congresswoman says she will continue to serve the people of California in the U.S. House. Here's part of her emotional speech to fellow lawmakers and her staff today.
Standing here today, I'm endlessly grateful for all of life's blessings. For my Democratic colleagues whose courage and commitment with the support of your families have made many of these accomplishments possible. In fact, could not have been done without you. For my dear husband, Paul, who has been my beloved partner in life and my pillar of support, thank you. We're all grateful for all the prayers and well wishes as he continues his recovery. Thank you so much. Our darling children, Nancy, Corinne, Christine, Jacqueline, Paul, and Alexandra, and our grandchildren, Alexandra and Madeline, Liam, Sean, and Ryan, Paul and Thomas, Bella and Octavio, they are the joys of our lives for whom we and we are so very, very proud of them and a comfort to us at this time. And for my brilliant, dedicated, and patriotic staff, under the leadership of Terry McCullough, together, working together, the finest group of public servants the House has ever known. Thank you all so much. And again, for those who sent me here, for the people of San Francisco, for entrusting me with the high honor of being their voice in Congress. In this continued work, I will strive to honor the call of the patron saint of our city, Saint Francis. Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. In this house, we begin each day with a prayer and a pledge to the flag. And every day, I am in awe of the majestic miracle that is American democracy. As we participate in a hallmark of our republic, the peaceful, orderly transition from one Congress to the next, let us consider the words of, again, President Lincoln, spoken during one of America's darkest hours. He called upon us to come together, to swell the chorus of the Union, when once again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. That again is the task at hand. A new day is dawning on the horizon, and I look forward, always forward, to the unfolding story of our nation, a story of light and love, of patriotism and progress, of many becoming one, and always an unfinished mission to make the dreams of today the reality of tomorrow. Thank you all. May God bless you and your families, and may God bless, continue to bless our veterans and the United States of America. Thank you all so much.
Pelosi's announcement comes after Republicans captured a narrow majority in the U.S. House following the midterm elections. Gun shops in Oregon are seeing a dramatic rise in requests for firearm background checks following the passage of Measure 114 in the recent midterm elections. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on that story.
Background checks for firearm sales are up fourfold in Oregon this week, following the passage of Measure 114. That measure regulates the sale of guns, making it a requirement to get a permit before buying. It also bans the sale of high-capacity magazines. Before the election, the Oregon State Police were processing an average of 849 requests per day. After the election, that average shot up to 4,092 requests per day through last Sunday. The daily average then fell a bit to 3,104 requests per day through Tuesday. Oregon does not have a system that allows officials to directly track the number of guns sold in the state. However, every time someone buys a firearm in Oregon, the state police process an online federal background check request. The checks are per person, not per gun, so a single check could represent multiple firearms purchased. In addition, if the potential buyer fails the background check, or there's a problem in processing it, the sale does not go through. But if the check stalls for some reason, current law allows the applicant to buy the gun after 3 business days have passed. The number of pending checks has also grown in the last week to more than 10,000, which is higher than at any point since 2017. This is important because anyone with a pending check will have to wait for their check to be processed before buying a gun once Measure 114 becomes active. The new law will go into effect December 8th, barring a lawsuit that stops it from proceeding. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Now that the midterm election is over, the Oregon Health Authority's director Patrick Allen announced today he'll step down in early January when current Governor Kate Brown's term ends. He told employees in an email today that he's sad to be leaving the work behind. Democrat Tina Kotek is about to become the new governor and had indicated during the campaign that she might replace Allen, who shepherded the state through the COVID pandemic, at times facing criticism, especially during the early days of the vaccine rollout. You may have tuned in with us on election night here on KBOO. One of our live guests was Dr. Chris Nichols, a historian and political author from The Ohio State University. Recently, we talked about the remarkable and unusual results of this midterm election. What was your big aha moment of the election? I have one, but I want to see what yours was. What was the moment you were like, oh, I can't believe it. I can't believe that just happened.
I think the thing that stood out to me was the people, including myself, who were looking at it closely, the thing that we all expected was that this would not be decided on election day. And that was absolutely correct. That anyone who prematurely was declaring victory for one party or the other, or in a whole host of specific campaigns, they were wrong, right? Mm-hmm. So judiciously withholding a full assessment seemed like the responsible thing to do. And the journalists and pundits who did not do that, and politicians, they were the ones who got burned. So that, I mean, that's one bigger takeaway. I think we should, for the near term, for maybe the next several election cycles, we should all pause on premature judgments, and even on polling, and even on, you know, good estimates of what districts are going to, how they'll turn out. As you look at how razor thin these margins are, thousands of votes, hundreds of votes, and you and I have talked about this several times, you know, you just can't predict that number. It's too statistically small. It's too modest. You know, a district leans, you know, R or D, but that does not help you when you're looking at, did you have quite enough turnout of a particular group? Okay, so big picture, thinking about turnout, we had that youth vote that we were thinking about. We had the younger generation came out and voted. I still am looking for all the statistics and data analysis, but it looks like this was a record midterm for people in the youngest age demographic of voters, and that they voted, it looks like, roughly 2/3 of them Democratic. Seems also important in thinking about the future of what the American electorate looks like, the kinds of issues they care about. Some people have, I think, prematurely were interested in the question of student debt relief and saying that that was central to this. And while I think that's undoubtedly part of it, when you look at polling of younger Americans, the Dobbs decision and women's reproductive rights stands out to me as one of the things that was incredibly important. But also, and not insignificantly, questions of democracy, that they actually really seemed to care about free and fair elections and weren't persuaded by election deniers, but rather wanted to reject election deniers. I think that, in the way I think about why they came out and voted as they did, that's kind of how I parse that. So I don't know if it counts as an aha moment, but the fact that so many young voters did come out and they seem to have been the margin of difference in this not being a red wave or even a red ripple, but rather a pretty modest set of gains that possibly barely gets the House to Republicans, and in a number of governorships and a number of state legislatures actually turn things blue, seems really important to me. And it certainly seems, looking to the future, like exactly what we need to be thinking about when we think about the next 5 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was like a splash, a puddle, yep. not a wave. For sure.
Mm-mm. What was yours? What stood out to you?
Mine was, I can tell you exactly what it was. I love election night because I'm sitting there geeking out with my friends over, yeah, you know, the stuff coming in. And one of them said, oh, yeah, Marie Glusenkamp-Perez is leading Joe Kent. And I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. She's leading Joe Kent? Oh, my God. And so I kept watching that one throughout the evening. And she kept that steady lead, you know, 52-53%. Yeah. And I was like, wow, that is going to be like the upset of this election if she mm-hmm. wins. Because she was given a 2% chance of winning on 538. And I thought she was a strong candidate. I'd seen her campaign and I've seen her debate. But because of the lean of that district, she was projected as having absolutely no chance. And that turned out to be just flat out wrong.
That was huge. And you look at the Brobert one, which Colorado's third, right? One big picture takeaway, although it wasn't decided the night of, is that something like 5 of the top election deniers were all rejected at the ballot box. You know, I mean, that gives me hope for democracy. So that's important. And that those folks won't be overseeing elections gives me more of a sense that, in fact, elections will continue to be free and fair and hopefully have more people able to come out. So, yeah. I mean, I think obviously the Fetterman win in Pennsylvania, you know, when that happened, I thought, oh, okay, this can't be a wave.
Portland nonprofit Bike Loud PDX is filing a lawsuit against the city. It says Portland has failed to meet its required obligations to provide safe street infrastructure under the Oregon Pedestrian and Bicycle Bill. That's a 1971 law requiring the state's cities to improve pedestrian and bicycle facilities whenever streets are built, reconstructed, or relocated. Bike Loud supporters plan to gather tomorrow at noon to ride to the Multnomah County Courthouse to file the lawsuit. They will start at the corner of Southeast 26th and Powell at the site of a memorial for Sarah Pliner, a chef who was killed while riding her bike to work in October. An elementary school counselor in Oregon is making sure students don't come to school hungry by asking their families about food insecurity. As KBOO's Owen Vastabel reports, there's a farmer's market just a few miles away from Beaver Creek in Oregon City.
An Oregon school counselor is helping families get the food they need so students can be ready to learn. Laura Minato is a counselor at Beaver Creek Elementary School outside Oregon City. She has been screening student families for food insecurity and says the idea came from a presentation by the American Heart Association. After that, Minato started including questions about food insecurity in the family needs survey she sends out to families.
It's more respectful and dignified if the family gets to self-identify. So having an opportunity to do that is important. And I'd never thought of it before I heard the talk from the AHA. I mean, that just kind of clicked with me like, oh, here's the way I could find that out.
Minato says the questions that resonated with her dive into whether families feel like they have enough food to last until their next paycheck. Minato also asks families if they would like to receive information about free food resources in the community. She says Beaver Creek is a small community and the elementary school plays an important role.
The school, which has been here for a long time, is definitely a hub of the community, and we are looked at as kind of a center, at least for the people who have school-age kids.
Minato says families who are struggling with food insecurity are given certificates that can be traded in for tokens to be used at the farmers market in Oregon City. She's curious if there are more barriers to food, such as distance to the market, and whether families feel comfortable going.
The next step that I would like to put some more effort into is actually helping them get used. I feel like there's more work to be done on that end.
For KBOO News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Owen Bastable.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio with the best of Native and Indigenous music from the rainforest. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves on the Vatican's role in the creation of the mission system. Tonight's weather, clear skies down to 30. Tomorrow's weather, sunny and up to 48. Today in history, we're looking at a moment and a famous phrase from a former president made on this date. Historian Dr. Chris Nichols helps us out with this one, too.
1973, Nixon, in a televised appearance, told the nation, "I am not a crook," referring to allegations concerning his involvement in the Watergate scandal. You did the hand signaling very well there. Okay, so,
yes.
So that was a very significant moment in American history. Never had anything like that happen before.
No, not really. In fact, yeah, the other big scandal that came before, the Teapot Dome scandal of the Harding years, was one where the president never said anything like, "I'm not a crook," and mostly was at fault because the people that he'd hired were the problem. In this case, Nixon was the problem, but he said he wasn't a crook. So that is November 1973, and he said that to a whole bunch of, in a press conference, to a whole bunch of newspaper editors. And the key moment here is that it comes after the 72 election and before 74, when Watergate culminates, and in August 74, he resigns. And one of the things that he says that isn't quoted there, right, in the "I'm not a crook," that's key, is that they don't have to impeach me. So he's already thinking almost a year before the fullness of the Watergate scandal comes to fruition with him resigning about impeachment. It's a really crucial thing to think about in the broader perspective, because as we think about presidential malfeasance, a kind of imperial presidency where presidents can order different foreign policies or make government investigate their enemies, not that we want that at all, but if you think about the ways in which the Nixon presidency operated, he really pioneered some of these techniques that we've seen later, particularly in the battles over the Trump presidency. The "I am not a crook" statement stands out as really the height of hypocrisy. His assertion there that he's not a crook underscores the fact that he was in fact acting like a crook, like a mob boss. And that's, when we think about Watergate, one thing that's interesting, if you think about it as a theory, is that it's like a signifier. This is a critical theoretical idea, and it signifies something. So you can say Watergate and people will know that it means something. And generally it means, you know, presidents doing the wrong thing, presidents undermining the Constitution. And that signifier is malfeasance or being a crook. And "I am not a crook" is the encapsulation of that statement.
A new study shows the nation's progress at lifting children out of poverty is losing momentum. The expansion of tax credits and free school meals during COVID-19 temporarily lifted more than 3 million kids out of poverty during 2021. But a new report from Child Trend shows that now the child poverty rate's at risk of being reversed or stalling, as Roz Brown reports.
A new study suggests progress made to reduce child poverty over the past 25 years in the U.S. is at risk of stalling or being reversed. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, a health philanthropy organization, has released a study that shows child poverty is on the rise after falling by 59% between 1993 and 2019. Policy expert Avinal Joseph says pandemic-related enhancement of child tax credit and earned income tax credit programs, as well as food stamps, lifted 3 million children out of poverty during the latter half of 2021, but Congress let those programs expire.
As a result, child poverty began to pick back up and is now increased by more than 40%. So we have undone all of the progress that we saw as a result of the temporary policies that were put in place.
U.S. Census Bureau data showed a slight drop in child poverty in New Mexico amid the coronavirus pandemic, largely attributed to the temporary relief payments and tax policies. This is National Hunger and Homeless Awareness Week, and Joseph says there's no separating the two.
Both hunger and homelessness are closely linked to poverty. People with lower income have a harder time affording rent or purchasing healthy foods, especially during a time when prices and interest rates are continuing to rise.
Without new or expanded programs, she believes the generational cycle of poverty will continue.
We have showed them what it's like to have consistent meals, a place to lay their head, some stability, and then just with sort of a strike of the time, a midnight, all of that has gone away.
Joseph says the report also found that Black and Latino children are approximately 3 times as likely as white children to live in poverty.
For some in this country, there are so many barriers that have been put in place that it's impossible for them to achieve their healthiest self or to achieve even a state of well-being, much less thriving.
This is Roz Brown.
Donald Trump launches his campaign for president in the 2024 race. The Senate advances the Respect for Marriage Act. Efforts ramp up to save the DACA program for immigrant children. With more on these stories, here's today's edition of 2022 Talks.
In order to make America great and glorious again, I am tonight announcing my candidacy for President of the United States.
Former President Donald Trump has launched his 2024 presidential campaign. It comes as he is the subject of several lawsuits, is being asked to testify before the House subcommittee investigating the January 6th attacks, and has been blamed as the reason Republicans did poorly in the recent midterm elections. Issues he plans to focus on are mandating the death penalty for drug dealers, sending National Guard troops to cities facing extreme violence, and what he called restoring election integrity by demanding voter ID, allowing only same-day voting and only paper ballots. By a vote of 62-37, the U.S. Senate voted to advance the Respect for Marriage Act, which would codify same-sex and interracial marriage rights. Maine Senator Susan Collins, one of 12 Republicans to support the bill, spoke about her vote.
Madam President, let us remember that we are talking about our family members, our friends, our co-workers, our neighbors. I'm proud to have stood with them, and I will continue to stand with them in efforts to protect and secure their rights.
Illinois Senator Dick Durbin is calling on the lame duck Congress to pass legislation to save the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program with bipartisan support.
We need 10 Republicans who will step up and join us in this effort. I can think of 4 or 5 as I stand here. We need more. And we need to say to them, take a look at America and take a look at this last election.
Members of the U.S. Postal Service testified before the House Oversight and Reform Subcommittee on Government Operations about holiday preparations. During the hearing, Chairwoman Carolyn Maloney proposed a mail-in voting bill to make voting by mail safer for those who do so.
The bill would require that all mail-in ballots include a barcode and are easier to sort and track. Our committee will mark up this bill tomorrow, and I hope it can be enacted into law this year.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Mary Peltola's lead widens over Sarah Palin in Alaska's congressional race. Hoskin calls on Congress to keep its delegate promise. The Coquille tribe reports a heavy Chinook salmon count. And a California tribal college celebrates new funding. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with the National Native News.
The principal chief of the Cherokee Nation is calling on the U.S. House of Representatives to keep a treaty promise to the Cherokee Nation by the United States to seat a Cherokee Nation delegate in the House. Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. testified Wednesday before the House Committee on Rules. Hoskin discussed the promise made in the 1800s.
Cherokee Nation and Cherokee Nation alone is the tribe that is the party to the Treaty of New Echota and the Treaty of 1866. Cherokee Nation has in fact adhered to our obligations under these treaties. I'm here to ask the United States to do the same. It's time for this body to honor this promise and seat our delegate in the House of Representatives.
Hoskin says it's a binding commitment which guaranteed the Cherokee Nation a voice in Congress in exchange for forcing them from their homelands. They were moved west on what became known as the Trail of Tears. The non-voting delegate chosen by the Oklahoma tribe is Kim Teehee. According to the Cherokee Nation, the House has the power to seat the delegate, and no further action is needed by the administration or the U.S. Senate. In the latest voting tallies in Alaska in the race for U.S. House, Congresswoman Mary Peltola, who's Yupik, has a sizable lead, which grew a little more. The Democrat is well ahead of her closest competitor, Alaska's former Republican Governor Sarah Palin, who has 26% of the vote. Although Peltola has 48% of the vote, she needs more than 50% to win under Alaska's new system of ranked choice voting. This will require votes from those who ranked her as a second choice. So far, only first choice votes have been counted. None of the candidates appear to be close to crossing 50%. Second and third rankings will be counted on November 23rd. Peltola is expected to win. She made history in August, becoming the first Alaska Native person to ever serve in Congress. She won a special election to fill out the remainder of the late Congressman Don Young's term. After years of dwindling returns, the Coquille tribe is excited to see at least 150 breeding pairs of fall Chinook salmon this year. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, that's one of the highest returns in nearly two decades.
Replenishing the salmon numbers has been an intensive team effort among the Coquille tribe, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Port of Bandon, and Coquille Salmon and Trout Enhancement Program. John Ogan is the Assistant Executive Director for Natural Resources for the Coquille Tribe.
Last year it was 24 breeding pairs, the year before that it was 3, and then in the neighborhood of 20 for a couple of years prior. In 2017, there were 88 breeding pairs collected. As I mentioned, the goal is 75. This year, we've kind of smashed that record with over 100 breeding pairs.
Fertilized eggs will be kept in incubation tanks, then moved to another hatchery where juvenile salmon will hatch. Eventually, they'll be released into the Coquille River system. The Coquille tribe declared an emergency last year, given the hard dive in Chinook numbers due to invasive bass, predators, and environmental challenges.
For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
This week, California Indian Nations College celebrated a $5 million state budget allocation to help the tribal college in its effort to gain federal accreditation. Native American Assembly member James Ramos helped secure the funding. A celebration was held at the college campus in Palm Springs. The funding's in the 2022-23 state budget. The lawmaker is hoping the college will help boost higher education attendance among Native American students in California who have low rates of going to college. There are 35 tribal colleges and universities across the country which are federally accredited. There is not one located in California. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The feds are holding a public meeting today about a proposed national monument in Nevada. As Suzanne Potter reports, advocates say the monument at Spirit Mountain would be a boon to the economy.
The proposed national monument, to be called Aviquemé, is getting a big boost today as top leaders of the Bureau of Land Management hold a public meeting in Laughlin. BLM Director Tracy Stone Manning will hear from a range of stakeholders on the 450,000-acre proposed monument near Searchlight. Taylor Patterson with the Native Voters Alliance of Nevada says the area is the center of the creation story for many human-speaking tribes.
It's the place where all of their traditional stories and knowledge comes from. And then for our southern Paiute tribes in the area, it's also a part of the Salt Song Trail. And so that tells really the life cycle of Paiute people and how they moved through the land and all the important places, plants, and animals in the area.
Aviquame is the Mojave name for Spirit Mountain. The area is also important habitat for mule deer and bighorn sheep. There has been no organized opposition to the project. However, Grace Palermo with Friends of Nevada Wilderness says past proposals to build a wind farm in the area galvanized efforts to protect the land.
The idea that huge wind turbines could go up in this area could really damage habitat for wildlife and the viewshed and possibly create access issues for folks who are out on these lands.
Louis Bubala with the Nevada Outdoor Business Coalition says a monument designation would get more people excited about visiting the area, adding to the state's $4 billion outdoor economy.
If we get a new national monument, you're going to have people exploring the land and visiting Searchlight, Laughlin, Boulder City. Henderson is a launching spot to get out there.
Craig Bakerjian is director of the Nevada Conservation League's Aviquame Coalition. He says the monument will further state and federal goals to preserve 30% of the land by 2030 and reduce carbon pollution to boot.
Climate change is a very real threat. And part of the way that we can mitigate that is with undisturbed natural resources, which act as natural carbon sinks.
Congresswoman Dina Titus filed a bill in February to create a new national monument, but President Joe Biden has the power under the Antiquities Act to make the designation on his own. I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Thursday, November 17th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Owen Bastable, Eric Tegadoff, Suzanne Potter, and Roz Brown. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell, so glad to have you with us.